In the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote of the station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled the colonists. He also wrote that people are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. What did Jefferson or other founders in 1776 think their creator or nature's God might be? Did their conception of a supreme being influence their drive for independence or their thinking about democracy? Matthew Stewart examines colonial thinking about God's nature and its historical impact in his new book, Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought Matthew Stewart to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
Laws of nature and nature's God doesn't seem like a natural pairing today. Do we have a clear sense of what Jefferson meant?
Well, the first thing to bear in mind is that that phrase in its own time could have been read in many different ways. So you can't say that there's a single meaning to it.
Do you think he meant it to be ambiguous?
I think he did, because if you understand the philosophical background within which Jefferson was writing, that phrase does mean something very different from what we take it to mean today and what perhaps some of the people at the time took it to mean. And so we need to do this exercise of translation. We need to understand the way they use those terms and then try to map that as best we can into our categories, even though it still won't necessarily fit.
Well, how do we translate it?
So nature's God originated out of a deep clash between certain radical ideas that originated in ancient Greece and that are very important in the philosophical tradition, a clash between those ideas and the mainstream or established religion in Europe. And in order to understand nature's God, you need to know that it was a deity that emerged really as an alternative to the established Christian conception of a deity. So it's a deity that is operates only through laws of nature, that's always accountable to reason, and that does not operate through revelation. Those are the most important facts about nature's God, or at least the nature's God that Jefferson and people like Thomas Paine or Thomas Young understood.
Are they going back to, you mentioned ancient Greeks, people like Lucretius and Epicurus?
Yes, that's right. So one of my big agendas here is to try to persuade Americans that our nation has a very deep philosophical heritage. It goes way back in time. It has very deep roots in human civilization. I think it begins in ancient Greece. There was a kind of enlightenment in Greece, and in that enlightenment, they hit upon a certain very deep idea of reason. They hit on the notion that the only real miracle in the world, the miracle of nature, is that there are no miracles, that everything can be explained. And the ideas that then percolated up through European history to arrive at the Declaration of Independence to change the way in which we govern ourselves come out of that very deep tradition. So that's why I throw around these ancient names of Lucretius and Epicurus. I think they really are important to the American story.
Well, this is occurring during the time of another Enlightenment. And were the various philosophers of the Enlightenment in England and France and elsewhere also thinking back to the ancient Greeks?
Well, they were. I mean, in many cases, they were literally reading Lucretius and responding to him, or other ancient sources, the Stoics, and of course the more traditional Aristotelian and Platonic sources. But to a greater extent than I think that most people appreciate today, there was a pretty deep unity in this early modern philosophy. It emerged starting in the late Renaissance, and it was deeply coherent and sort of unfolded in a pretty organic way through the 17th century before it appeared in America.
The other phrase that I mentioned, our creator, seems clear, but didn't Jefferson put things differently in an earlier draft of the Declaration of Independence?
Yes. In the first draft that Jefferson himself wrote, he said that people had their equal rights in virtue of their equal creation. So there literally was no creator in the first draft of the Declaration of Independence. And then I believe it was John Adams who suggested let's put the active subject there, the creator, in, and it sounds a little bit better. But there's a really important point hidden in that, and that's that in this universe of nature's God, the philosophical religion of deism, it's ultimately very hard to draw a distinction between the creator and the creation. They end up being sort of two synonyms or two sides of the same coin, and that's why I think that shows up in the first draft.
We'll get to deism in a moment. My guest is Matthew Stewart. His book, Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic, it's published by W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How important is language, like the things we've been discussing in the Declaration of Independence, to America's religious conservatives when they insist that the United States is a Christian country? So, in 2007, Senator John McCain said that the Constitution established a Christian nation, that he would be uncomfortable with a Muslim president, but okay with a Mormon one, although I'm not sure how he felt about the possibility of a Jewish, Hindu, or Buddhist president, or a Taoist. But the Constitution doesn't have any overtly religious language in it, does it?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, frankly, I think America's founders have been kidnapped by religious conservatives, and it makes me angry. The United States, the establishment of the United States, was really a remarkable episode in world history. It was the world's first secular republic. The Constitution has no reference to God. It specifically excludes a religious test, even before you get to the Bill of Rights that prohibits Congress from establishing a religion. So the notion that it's a Christian republic in any formal sense, I think, is a betrayal of the American Revolution and of what the incredible accomplishment that America made in those early years.
But hasn't it always been a very religious place? Didn't Alexis de Tocqueville write, "The religious aspect of the country was the first thing that struck my attention"?
It wasn't always that way. So it's America has a more problematic relationship with religion than I think most people appreciate. It's certainly the case that during the Revolutionary period there was a lull or a backsliding in religious matters. Timothy Dwight wrote a poem calling the age the triumph of infidelity, and John Adams referred to it as the age of Thomas Paine. So there certainly was a lot of infidelity, religious infidelity at the time. It's also important to remember that the religion was not unified, that if there was a universal religious belief, it was pretty much that the people in the next town over were doomed to eternal damnation because they had the wrong religious belief. So the notion that there was a kind of single creed that unified everybody isn't true to begin with.
And isn't that one of the reasons the founding fathers made this into a secular nation? Because there were so many different fervent religious believers who disagreed with each other. The only way they all could get along, because we see what happens when that doesn't, when that kind of thing isn't happening, as we're seeing in Iraq and Syria and other places, in Israel and Palestine, we wind up with the situations where people fight each other. So secularism is one of the possible solutions.
It is, and we should bear in mind that even before the Revolution, America's colonials had experienced the harm of religious conflict. They had seen how when sects get out of control, they can cause these huge problems. So yes, it was an important part of the wisdom of America's founders to understand that a secular government would be the way to ensure that you'd have harmony and peace.
And the increasing emphasis on reason and individualism of Enlightenment thinking is often cited as the great intellectual movement behind the American Revolution. Do you think that the popular conception is mistaken or incomplete?
I think it's simplified. So I think it's true that there is that America's founders hit on the importance of reason.
And Thomas Paine named a major work, The Age of Reason.
That's right. So that part of the story is certainly true. I think it's probably simplified. We tend to look at science as a kind of straightforward thing these days. In that early world, they had much more sophisticated ideas about science and about the way you investigate nature and how that relates to our moral and political well-being. So there's a more complicated story, but I think it's fine to say that, yes, this was basically a republic of reason. It was the first republic in the world created on the basis of ideas. And that's something that they understood clearly. That's something that they thought was radically new in the world and that we should really appreciate.
Let's address the whole matter of deism. A number of the founders have been referred to as deists. Can you explain deism?
So there's a superficial understanding of deism, which is just that it's a theological doctrine, and it involves the idea that there is a God who creates a world of mechanical wonders, a kind of machine, and then he walks away to the sound of ticking noises, and we're sort of left to fend for ourselves.
So there are no miracles.
There's no miracles.
There's no inerrancy of the scriptures. There's no Holy Trinity.
Right, and perhaps most importantly, there's no intervention. So this is a God who creates the world and then says, you're on your own, guys. And that actually isn't even the worst of it from a theological perspective, if you're relatively orthodox, because as these philosophers appreciated, when you push deism to its limit, it's hard to distinguish this deity who creates the universe from the universe itself. And so deism naturally migrates to a kind of pantheism where you identify the God in the universe. And that's pretty close to atheism, where I think of it as a kind of functional atheism.
But there's a prime mover, as St. Thomas Aquinas. Was it Aquinas who said that? Did any of the revolutionary thinkers 240 or 250 years ago actually call themselves deists?
Oh, yes. Thomas Young got into a big spat with one of the evangelical preachers, George Whitefield, a leader of the Great Awakening, and they were at loggerheads in the newspapers of Boston, and he stood up and said in the newspapers, the religion of nature, more properly called the religion of nature's God, deism from Deus, that is truth. I boldly defy thee to contest. So he's saying, I am a deist. I believe in the religion of nature. And that's emphatically not Christianity, except in a kind of watered-down sense that it shares with all other religions. So, yes, some of them did call themselves deists, but many
Jefferson?
Of them avoided the title.
Would Jefferson have thought of himself as a deist?
No, Jefferson was very good about avoiding any kind of label. I mean, he said famously, I am in a sect of one. Nobody knows my religion. Don't tell anybody. And at the same time, when you look at the beliefs that he expresses, especially in his letters and letters to John Adams in particular, I think it's fair to classify him as a kind of deist.
You mentioned Thomas Young. He is one of the people who stands out a lot in your account, along with Ethan Allen. He sounds like a real character, Thomas Young.
He is. He was a true revolutionary. And, as I went exploring.
Why is he unknown today?
Well, he's unknown today because he made the mistake of declaring his deism and his religious infidelity too publicly. So when he died in 1777, after making incredible contributions to the American cause, people were pretty glad to forget him. But he was one of my discoveries, my ways into the project. He's not the whole story of the American Revolution by any stretch, but this is the man who kicked off the Boston Tea Party. He stood up and said that he was the first one to say, we have to throw the tea into the harbor. And that was actually just the warm-up act. He was also involved in the Pennsylvania Revolution of 1776, and he co-wrote the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, which is really a remarkable document. It's the first constitution for a modern secular state.
He also played a moderating role at what became known as the Boston Massacre.
That's right. He was a rabble-rouser. He was a self-taught doctor, and his people were the people of the streets. So he was part of the kind of the social revolution in America. A lot of conservatives want to believe that the American Revolution involved no change in class structure. Well, that's not quite true, because people like Thomas Young were fighting for the people in the streets. But when the Boston Massacre happened, he understood that if the mob or his people got too crazy, that would be a real problem. It would set them back. And so he went out with his sword in his hand and said, listen, guys, calm down. Don't start a riot now. And so he used his rabble-rousing powers to sort of put out the rabble in that case.
Do you think he'd be better remembered if a furniture company had been named after him?
Especially, that's one of the great injustices of history for Ethan Allen, though. I mean, he spent his life fighting New Yorkers, and then some New York businessmen named their furniture company after him.
He's remembered for leading the Green Mountain Boys and helping to found the state of Vermont. Did he play a larger role?
Well, he played a very significant role in the unfolding of the War of Independence, because his attack on Ticonderoga was the first offensive assault in the war and kind of kicked the ball very far out in front of where a lot of people wanted it to be. And then the artillery that was recovered from that fort was used by Washington in the Siege of Boston. So, and he was also a celebrity prisoner of war. He wrote this narrative that was a bestseller. So he was really quite an important figure and a real hero, which then was a problem after he published his philosophy book, which was quite heretical. I mean, he was identified then as an infidel, and then the historians had trouble figuring out what to do with him.
You suggested Ethan Allen was on Herman Melville's mind when he wrote, with the soul of an atheist, he wrote down the godliest of things.
Yeah, I think Herman Melville was on his own mind when he wrote down that particular line. But Herman Melville thought a lot about Ethan Allen, and he wrote about Ethan Allen. And I think he grasped something important about Ethan Allen, that there is that peculiar Western spirit that Ethan Allen represents, and that in Melville's mind is associated with his kind of religious and philosophical adventurism, the fact that this was a bold speculator who would sit up there on the mountains with his bottle of whiskey and think the most unorthodox, the most unusual thoughts.
The kinds of thoughts that still can get you into trouble.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Matthew Stewart's book is Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic. It's published by W.W. Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Matthew Stewart, who is the author of a number of books. The most recent, the one we are discussing, is Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic. It is published by Norton. What did the leaders of the time think about the origins of their thinking? What did they trace it to? You write about the Saxon mythology.
One of the astonishing things about someone like Thomas Jefferson is just how well-read he was. I mean, this is a man who turned over 7,000 or so books to the Library of Congress, and that was the cornerstone of the National Library at the time. And he read them quite closely. So he was very well aware of where these ideas were coming from. And that's why it's particularly interesting to go through his library. He has a shelf that's dedicated to moral philosophy in particular. And it's a fascinating shelf. That's only about 150 books. But what you find there is that he has a lot of people who were burned at the stake, a lot of people who were considered to be quite radical or heretical in their time. And these are the people that he identified as the original sources for his ethical and political thinking.
You write, and I'm quoting, "Like revolutionaries throughout history, Young and his gang understood that in order to change the future, it's necessary first to change the past." What were Young and others like him doing?
Well, you mentioned the Saxon mythology, and that certainly was an important part of the story. America's revolutionaries believed that there had been this sort of idyllic, almost Edenic state on the British Isles before the Normans came over. That's the Saxon period. That's before 1066.
They must have been reading Ivanhoe.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
No,
if they got
Ivanhoe's after the
fact. Yeah, I think that the timing's not right there. But they were reading Tacitus. That's the main source for this. And they were also reading a lot of what are called Whig historians who were taking Tacitus and turning it a little molehill into a giant mountain. There are a couple of things to bear in mind about ancient Saxony. This is the Saxon myth. One is that it is pre-Christian and pre-European. So the idea is that these are kind of noble savages to some degree. And the second is that they were democratic. This is the myth, that the Saxons had established some kind of rule of the people. Now, the myth didn't have a lot of grounding in reality, but it was very important for people like Jefferson and Thomas Young because it gave them an idea of some sort of earlier authentic self that they could recover.
Would Franklin also have been of similar mind or John Adams?
Franklin was also an incredibly well-read, well-versed American thinker, but he was also pretty pragmatic. And, I think he would have looked on the Saxon myth as a bunch of baloney.
Jefferson had a library of 7,000 books. That would have had to have been one of the largest libraries in the colonies. I mean, that's a major book collection anywhere right now.
It is, and he turned it over to Congress when he needed money, it was the cornerstone of the Library of Congress. But what's interesting also is that he held some books back. Now, which books did he hold back? Well, among other things, he held back some editions of Lucretius and also of the French philosopher Pierre Gassendi, who was one of the early commentators on the Epicurean philosophy. These were really important to Jefferson at that time because he was trying to synthesize this moral vision, and he was turning to these ancient philosophers to do that.
How did he reconcile it with his attitudes about slavery?
Yeah, I don't think he did a very good job on that one. When you read his comments on in the Notes on the State of Virginia about slavery and about African Americans, frankly, it's disturbing reading and it's convoluted. You can't really forgive him for that.
Well, of course, when you think that Anglo-Saxon culture is the ultimate, the ideal, then that justifies being superior to everybody else, doesn't it? Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense, was tremendously influential in fomenting popular support for the revolution. Wasn't he one of the most revolutionary of all in his thinking?
Well, he certainly was very revolutionary. I don't think he was more revolutionary than someone like Thomas Young. And in fact, I think their ideas were really a very close match. And I would throw Ethan Allen and even Thomas Jefferson to some extent in that same group.
But Teddy Roosevelt only called Paine that filthy little atheist.
You know, when Paine became famous for writing Common Sense, his religious views were not out in the open. You could argue whether he had them fully formed at the time. I think he did, but you know, he was, like most people at the time, reticent about it. But when you read his that work in the light of what he wrote later, The Rights of Man and the Age of Reason, frankly, I think you have to conclude that they form a piece, that his philosophical radicalism was very much linked to his political radicalism, to his revolutionary spirit. And that same connection, I think, is evident in people like Jefferson. So that's why I think that this kind of heretical philosophy isn't just a sort of accident that appeared, an intellectual fashion that happened to afflict American elites in the 18th century. I think that it was there because the philosophy that they were drawing on to reorganize the world, to make possible this incredible experiment in self-government, that philosophy was deeply heretical.
Weren't several of the founders referred to as atheists? Were they atheists as we would recognize atheists to be today?
Yeah, not just atheists, but Jefferson was called a howling atheist and a confirmed infidel.
Well, of course, there was a lot of personal political rhetoric.
I mean, when Ethan Allen died, the ministers were saying that, and he's down in hell now, lifting his eyes up in torment. I mean, yeah, they were identified as atheists. Benjamin Franklin was called many times a professed infidel or a man of whom the infidels plume themselves much. So that's the way they were perceived. And, you know, yeah, it was a simplistic characterization, but there was a lot of truth to it.
Was there any tension between people like Thomas Jefferson or John Adams, who were quite wealthy, and others who were not, like Thomas Young and Ethan Allen?
Well, there certainly was tension, and the American Revolution didn't resolve those class issues to any great degree. During 1776, they got together. I mean, the people who led the Pennsylvania Revolution, people like Thomas Young, Thomas Paine, James Cannon, and James Matlock, they were representatives of the lower orders. And they worked with John Adams, but they never resolved the tension. And in fact, John Adams then, you know, said, oh, these are Democrats. They're sort of people of the mob, and I really don't like them.
You said that Ethan Allen represented a kind of Western adventurism. Were these ideas more likely to pop up in Western Massachusetts or Vermont or upstate New York, which was then the West of the United States?
Yeah, so, you know, Crevecoeur, the French explorer, was writing around in 1782. He wrote these letters to an American farmer. He had a theory that, in fact, the frontier was where religion goes to die. And the argument was that, you know, people are out there on their own making their way. It's just, you know, man versus nature. They become self-reliant. They meet people who have different belief systems, and they finally figure out that none of those beliefs matter very much, that we all just need to get along, and, you know, the only true belief is being kind to your fellow man and so on. So that was one theory. Now, that was belied to some extent by later American history, where the frontier turned out to be the hotbed of revival religion. So it's a complicated picture.
My guest is Matthew Stewart. His book, Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic. Today, seven states, including Texas and North Carolina, constitutionally ban atheists from holding public office. Arkansas even bans people who, quote, deny the being of a God from testifying as witnesses. It's a good way to get out of jury duty, I suspect. Would George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or John Adams have been barred from office by such standards?
Well, that's a good question. No, I don't think they would have been banned as long as the requirement was a sort of general profession. On the other hand, would they have opposed such a requirement? Absolutely. And in fact, they did oppose it. And in fact, in the U.S. Constitution, Article 6 makes clear that there shall be no religious test whatsoever. It's unambiguous. In the case of the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, there was a vicious, bitter debate over the inclusion of a religious test. And at first, it was a religious test that required a declaration of faith in Christianity. That got watered down to being just a declaration of faith in God. But even that was not satisfactory for a lot of people. And people like Thomas Young thought it was unacceptable and probably would have been barred from office.
Was there a debate about all of this among the signers of the Constitution?
There was a debate, and the debate was resolved, and it was resolved against the idea of imposing a religious test.
You note that John Adams observed that the American Revolution took place in the minds of the people, and this was effected from 1760 to 1775 before a drop of blood was shed. So was the attitude of the general populace different than it might be today?
So his point was that long before there was this Declaration of Independence, the Americans began to feel themselves separate from Great Britain, and it took some time to cultivate that. Now, that movement for independence was to some degree just a kind of local nationalism. It was just the way in which people here wanted to break free from some rulers that they didn't like. But it required the effort of a lot of people working behind the scenes to actually make it happen. And that's where I think the story gets really interesting, because who were those people behind the scenes? They were the shadowy figures that are now called the Sons of Liberty. They were the radical faction in Boston. And that's an interesting cast of characters. They have a variety of viewpoints. You can't say that they're religious or irreligious, but certainly a fair number of them were on the, let's say, on the kind of edges of society. And that Thomas Young, I think, is the probably best example of one of those, an early revolutionary.
What were conditions like for the average colonist in 1770? Were the colonies too different to even talk about an average colonist?
Yeah, they were they're very different, and the experiences were very different up and down. But there was a surprising degree of frustration with the imperial rule. I mean, people, you know, tried to get basic things done. They tried to acquire land in order to settle it. They tried to start up enterprises. And that was often made very difficult by a corrupt imperial hierarchy.
Despite the fact that we were so far from Britain, the home country?
Yes. And, you know, the British imperial rule was just not very effective at dealing with this disgruntled population. I mean, I'm not an expert on the specifics of that struggle for independence, but my general sense is that Britain could have managed it much more effectively than they did.
How did thinking evolve after the Revolution, as the Constitution was drafted and a new government was formed? Did things remain consistent for a while?
To some degree, there was a falling off of the revolutionary spirit. I mean, you have to remember that going through independence, a war, and revolution, these are extreme events. Most people can't really live at that degree of intensity for very long. And so they went through it. They had this intense experience. It brought forth many of these fairly exotic characters. And then afterwards, I think there was a strong desire to settle down, to deal with the economic wreckage, to recover, and to set up a stable form of life.
But interestingly, in 1797, the Treaty of Tripoli states that the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. That's pretty bold. I mean, that's pretty explicit. Was that language aimed simply at satisfying the other signatories of the treaty, the North African Muslim states of the Barbary Coast, or was this an important statement to the American public?
Well, I think it's important because it reflects something about the general understanding at the time. So that treaty was passed by the Senate with no problem, by John Adams. It was published in newspapers around the country. No one apparently thought that this was a big deal.
It John was McCain obviously hasn't read this paper.
He hasn't read it. I mean, but people at that time understood that the United States represented this bold experiment in self-government through reason on secular foundations. People within it can be religious, but when we govern ourselves, we appeal to common reason and not to a particular religion. They understood that. They published it. No one had a problem with it until Sarah Palin and John McCain came to town.
Well, Tocqueville observed American religiosity in the 1830s, not that many years later. How devout were American colonists? Had things changed all that much over 35 years?
We need to say a couple things about Tocqueville. One is that he was here in 1830. This was sometime after the Revolution and at the height of the Great Awakening. A second important thing to know about him is that he got a lot of his information not from his field trip, which lasted 9 months, but from talking to people like Jared Sparks at Harvard. And these were people who had a particular evangelizing mission for the United States. And a third important point to remember about Tocqueville is that his analysis is not quite as simple as most people seem to think. He understood that democracy carries with it a risk of despotism, the tyranny of the majority. And this kind of religious fervor, he thought, it's fine as long as it's a certain kind of private religion, but to the extent that it turns into a mass movement, it can become the source of despotism.
Matthew Stewart's book, Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic, is published by W.W. Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
It was my pleasure, Leonard.